Well, I already introduced myself, so I won't say anything more about that. But Thomas is working on a brain music interface, and he's able to control a musical instrument by doing so. He's also working out of DX Arts, which is, of course, at the University of Washington School of Music area. He's also a neuroscientist, neurologist, and he's just starting some trials, I guess, with some people who maybe he can talk more about that, who could probably benefit from just being able to control things with their brain. So, Thomas Duell.
There we go. Well, I'm not an audio engineer. I was a sound guy for a band in high school. That's about it. We're going to need to get the video up. I'm plugged in. Source HDMI. Yeah, maybe just to wake up the projector, perhaps. That one. I'll play over here. Yeah, that might work. It was, I mean, that's all it took before. Okay, I'll look at. That's looking good. I think it's about to pop up.
No. That's what it's been.
It just flashed. Time. Yeah. We have displays on here.
References.
Yeah.
We discovered. I got this cable, and this is the first time we've used it. And it says source on this end, and display on this end. Cable doesn't matter. Steve
Lampen from Belden
says the guys in the warehouse are happy to put an arrow on cables.
Is that an Epson PJ?
Which way the electrons flow better?
Is that an Epson PJ?
But this one,
because it says Epson PJ here.
It would not work. And so we swapped around and it worked right away. Until now.
That's. Wait. It's flashing here, so on my screen when you do that. So. Hey, all right. We're back. I'm going to assume the audio should be easy. That's fine. I don't think there's any. Okay. Yeah, it was. All right, we'll try again. So I am going to talk to you a little, I'll give you a little bit of my background. I'm going to talk about EEG in general, because this device is driven by EEG or electroencephalogram. So I'll give you some of the basics of EEG, how that works. And I'll talk a bit about the history of EEG signal being turned into sound and into music, sort of what's been done up till now. And then I'll get into my device, how it works, and some experiments and applications of it. And you probably have questions at the end, I'm guessing, but we could do them along the way as well. So my background that kind of brought me here, I had started off as a music major in college. I was doing music composition and theory, and then I switched. I was doing science at the same time. I ended up doing science. And to some of you, I said, you know, I kind of wimped out. But I kept up with music, composition, and theory, and performance. I went on to do an MD-PhD program at Harvard and MIT, which was a combined program between the two institutions. And the PhD was in neuroscience. While I was in graduate school, I also did a certificate in jazz at New England Conservatory in Boston, and I did my residency in neurology. My specialty is neurology at Mass General and Brigham and Women's Hospitals. And then I did two fellowships in neurophysiology, so that's electrical signals of the nervous system, at Beth Israel in Boston, and then UW here. So now I'm a practicing neurologist at Swedish Hospital, where I'm an inpatient neurologist. So I mostly deal with more serious neurological problems if you have to be admitted to the hospital, mostly stroke, but anything that can affect the brain, spinal cord. I also am a neurophysiologist at the hospital, so that mostly means reading EEGs, electrical activity of the brain, which I'll talk about. And then I, at the School of Music and at DX Arts, I'm an assistant professor, and I teach a class called Art and Brain, and do music cognition. And then there's a Art and Brain lab that I run. And then I also have my art studio and laboratory there at the university, where I do audio art installation, but work mostly on the encephalophone, the brain music device I'll talk to you about in a bit. And I've had a few grants along the way, not big ones, but they've mostly been arts grants, so from 4 Culture and 92, which I'll talk about a bit, and more recently from the NEA. So again, I'll talk about EEG. I'll talk a little bit about music and sound that's been generated from EEG, and then I'll talk briefly about brain-computer interfaces in general, and then I'll describe my device and show you some examples. So EEG, or electroencephalogram, is it's a medical imaging technique that reads the electrical activity of the brain at the scalp, and that's the electrical activity generated by brain structures, which are under the scalp and the skull. We use metal electrodes and conductive media gel. It's historically been used mainly for diagnosis of epilepsy, as well as sleep disorders, but it's been used more and more for research, both for epilepsy and sleep disorders, but also for cognitive neuroscience. Advantages of using EEG versus some other types of imaging include very precise temporal resolution, so millisecond resolution in time, and then its non-invasiveness. So you simply put electrodes on the head and you might get a little bit of gel goop, but you're not really harming anyone. So those are big advantages, but it has a lot of disadvantages as well, and those include pretty poor to moderate to poor spatial resolution, so only a few centimeters of resolution. And then large amounts of artifact. There are all kinds of things that create artifacts, particularly from non-brain signals. So we're measuring microvolt level electrical activity at the scalp, and that's partially because the original signal is not very strong, but also because it's getting attenuated from the fluid around the brain, the skull, the skin getting attenuated and diffused. But also there are these other signals nearby I'll talk about as well, like muscle, which also your muscles generate electrical signal as well, and it's much stronger. Not only is it physically closer, but it's a much stronger signal, so more on the millivolt level. So if you have muscle firing nearby, one of these electrodes, they're going to pick up the muscle much more readily than the brain signal. So it makes it a very kind of delicate signal. I sort of think of it as listening very carefully to something quiet in a room full of people. You have to make sure all the other people are quiet before you can hear the person across the room. You can try to get closer, but we can only get so close with these electrodes. Those are sort of your tools to work with. So what are some of this, what is some of this noise and artifact? Up here, I'll go back here. This is up on the right. That's a pretty typical EEG. That's normal brain signal. The x-axis going across is time. That's about 10 seconds. And then you have about 20 squiggly lines there. Each one of those represents a different electrode, actually an electrode pair, but they're each different electrodes in the brain. And the y-axis is voltage. So those are sort of, you know, maybe 20, 30 microvolt deflections going up and down. That's a normal looking EEG. This is also normal, but this is some of the noise and artifact that you'll see. On the left, we have, again, the similar idea, time going across and voltage. You see those two or three big deflections down there. Those are eye blinks. So in the front, you have the electrodes here. If you blink your eyes, your eyeball goes up. It's called a Bell's phenomenon. And you may not believe this, but when you blink your eyes, your eyeballs go up like this. And there's a big dipole there. So as the eyeball goes up, that positive of the cornea relative to the negative in the back of your retina goes up, and you get a big deflection in the electrode. It picks that up. That's not brain. That's your eyeball. So that's one example of a large signal that can get in the way. On the right there, all the really kind of dark squiggly lines, when it's really dense, that's muscle. So that is, those are on the temporal leads. That's almost definitely from somebody clenching down. You have these muscles of mastication, your chewing muscles. They go, you know, you have muscles up in your head as well. And if you bite down, you can feel them up all the way up here. That's a temporalis muscle. So that muscle's right under a lot of these electrodes. And again, the muscle has a much stronger signal than brain, and it's higher frequency. So that's what all that red is right there. And then there's also some eye blinks, those big deflections like that. So these are some big sources of noise. There's also problems from poor conductance of the electrodes or electrical line noise, the 60 hertz we have everywhere. Other electronics, even cell phones in the wrong place can cause noise. Artifact, as I said, from the eye movement and the muscle. Glossokinetic, so that's your tongue, also has a big dipole. So if you're talking or chewing, there'll be a big deflection. If I'm reading an EEG of a patient, I can tell if they're chewing or they're talking without looking at the patient, just from the electrodes. And then another problem with EEG is that we don't know what a lot of the signal means, quite honestly. There's a certain amount of signal that we see and we recognize it's normal and, you know, it's a generally recognizable pattern, but we may not even know what it actually means. We know what some of them mean, or we know what some of them are associated with, but the truth is that a lot of the signal, we don't know its actual significance. And we continue to learn. So these are all the reasons why EEG is difficult to work with. I think a lot of people see this and they think it's magic. We're listening to the whole, you know, the brain as it's thinking and doing things, but it's not a magic wand. We can't read what that means most of the time, and it's a messy signal. We got a question.
The signals you get off the scalp, do you get a lot of external junk comes along for the ride, like hum?
Like what?
Power line hum.
Yes. Yeah. You can't. When you get a real careful EEG of a patient, you can put them into a room, and it's a fairly electrically isolated room, and you don't get much of that. But if you just have to go into a typical hospital room, bedroom, you'll get a lot of that. Or, you know, if you're in a laboratory or whatever. So,
you have to filter it out?
Yeah, so one way you can do it is just do a notch filter around 60 hertz. It'll take care of the line noise. And yeah, so we do that a lot. And there's all kinds of sources. Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Thank you. So we divide the EEG tracings. A lot of the real brain signal is periodic, so it comes in nice periodic signal that we can divide up into frequency ranges. These are pretty arbitrary, and they can be really confusing. They're just Greek letters dividing up the different frequencies. So delta is the slowest. And again, it depends on your source. Some people will divide them up slightly different. Really, delta is anything that's periodic at all from 0 to 4 hertz. Theta, 4 to 8. Alpha, 8 to 12 is typical. Beta, 13 to, yeah, or 12 to 30. And then there's gamma, which is higher than that. But all these are, you know, they'll use these letters. There's beta activity, there's alpha activity. They're just frequency ranges. So we divide them up into these frequency ranges to describe them. There are other normal patterns that are not artifact that are can help us with interpreting what's going on a bit. So this is a very typical EEG tracing here. Again, about 20 electrodes going across. The electrodes are numbered, odd numbers on the left, even numbers on the right, and then by regions like central for C for central, F for frontal, P for parietal, O for occipital in the back of the brain. And this is time, and each one of these big hashes is 1 second, so each of these are 200 milliseconds, these little hashes, so that's I don't know, 12 seconds or so across. So on the left half of the page, this is totally normal EEG. Left half of the page, the patient has their eyes open. Then they close their eyes right here, and you see that eye blink artifact that I talked about. And then you can see things changing here. They have their eyes closed in the second half. So the first half, these little things called lambda waves here are indicators of scanning around. So if you're reading or if you're looking at a pattern or something with your eyes, this is what you'll get, these lambda waves, and they represent the they're in the back of the brain in the occipital part. That's the visual cortex. So you're doing some kind of scanning activity or reading, and then the eyes close here, and then we get this thing called a posterior dominant rhythm. You can see this really regular thing that's around 10 hertz, and it's in the alpha frequency range. So that's 8 to 12 hertz. This is typical for people, and just about everybody has one of these. When you close your eyes, there's a 10-12 hertz pattern back here, also in the visual cortex, and that is something you'll see all the time when someone's awake. They're alert, but they have their eyes closed. What this is like a holding pattern for the visual cortex. It means nothing's going on. Your eyes are closed, so it's not getting input, but you're ready and alert. This will kind of become important because I'll be talking about this one and another sort of holding. Each of the regions of the brain have their own holding pattern. They're all similar to this, where they're in about 10 hertz, and that part of the brain is not doing anything particular, but it's resting but ready. You're not asleep or drunk. It'll go away if you get drunk. So this is another one. This one's called the mu rhythm. So now we're in a different part of the brain here. This is in the motor cortex. So it's not the back of the brain with the visual cortex we saw back there, but much up here in the motor cortex. And this mu rhythm is also a holding pattern for that part of the brain. So when the motor cortex, which controls your movement, is ready but not really doing anything, the mu rhythm is here. If you go and you move your hand, it's going to go away because it's no longer in the holding pattern. It's getting engaged into other patterns. And that's pretty neat because it'll turn on and off when you move. But what's really interesting is that people notice that not only when you move your hand, but when you think about moving your hand, it'll go away as well. And that's really key if you want to use some kind of signal that you can turn on and off without movement. And so this became one of several signals that people started to latch on to use for brain-computer interfaces to try to control things without movement. So it was a pattern that we knew. We knew the basic idea behind it. We did not know the exact function of it, but we saw that it was observably there when you're not doing anything and goes away when you move or, importantly, think about moving. So the imagination rehearsal of imagery of that movement will make it go away. So you think of people working on their golf swing or like tennis players, and probably heard how if you practice mentally, it's almost as good as doing the actual practice. Well, what's pretty neat is a lot of the brain signal is very similar. If you're practicing or imagining, then as the actual activity. They're not that far off. There's probably just a little thin line between the connection to say go ahead and actually move and send the signal to the muscles and the imagery. So most of the same circuitry is engaged, and that's all neat in theory, but what's really nice about this signal for brain-computer interfaces is it's something that you can have someone think about and use that as a switch or a control for a device. And this is the main signal that I use in my device. So this is just showing all the different frequency ranges here, frequencies on the x-axis, and here's the power of that signal, that frequency range, when you're relaxed, not doing anything, and then you imagine hand movement. So alpha is the mu rhythm. This is the one that goes down here. There's also beta and gamma that you can use, but this is just much easier to measure in this frequency range, and the signal change is bigger in the alpha range. So that's this mu rhythm before and after thinking about movement. So since the beginning of EEG, people have thought about, well, there's this periodic signal, and I think a lot of people thought, oh, this kind of reminds me of sound, or, you know, sound waves. The frequency ranges are pretty different, right? If you have 10 hertz, you're not going to be able to hear that if you just translated it directly. But from early on, people thought, well, you know, we can not only watch this as tracings on a page, but let's try to listen to it and turn it into sound somehow. So Hans Berger was this German neurophysiologist who was the first description of EEG. He described the posterior dominant rhythm, and then these other two, Adrian Matthews in 1929, or they were a little while later, I think they were in 1932 or whatever, were replicating his results, and they turned their own EEG into sound right away. This is the only picture I've found of Hans Berger, and he has this disturbing piece of brain there. What's most disturbing is it looks not only human, but it doesn't look complete. It looks like a part of a human brain. Kind of disturbing. Yeah.
What do you mean that they turned it into sound?
So they sonified it. I don't know the details because they didn't actually describe that very well, but I think they simply multiplied the frequencies of the posterior dominant rhythm, which is at around 10 hertz. I think they multiplied it times 100 or something and then just turned it into a sine wave, but I believe. Yeah. So others, artists, have thought of using this for sound installations and musical performance, and the composer Alvin Lucier did a piece in 1965, some of you may have heard of, called Music for Solo Performer. And so what he did there was he controlled percussion instruments using the posterior dominant rhythm with EEG, and so opening and closing the eyes, you remember that signal, the posterior dominant rhythm. When your eyes are closed, it's that holding pattern is there in the back of the brain. When you open your eyes, it goes away. So use that, and they had a performance that was in collaboration with John Cage. This is audio, but it should be video. This is a bit of a long one, so I might show you the beginning and then cut to the middle. So of course, being a really a performance art piece, the entire preparation is part of the performance. That's also very John Cage-like. So it's really long. We watch him sitting here, and then they apply the electrodes. It's about 15 minutes, so I'm going to let it go for a minute, and then I'll cut to the actual sound, which doesn't happen until 7 minutes. That's Alvin Lucier, yeah. John Cage was in the back, sort of like the wizard behind the curtain. And apparently, another artist and researcher documenting this said that they had a lot of technical problems. And so apparently John Cage kind of cheated, and he was watching the meter, and he kind of raised and lowered the level on his own because it wasn't working. The show must go on.
Was this in front of an audience?
Yeah. Yeah, it was at the Art Museum at Brandeis University.
Was
Okay, so I will escape out of this, and I should have the video. Yeah, okay, so here's 5 minutes and 35 seconds into it. We're still waiting for audio. Got the electric. There's a timpani with a actuator onto a mallet, basically. Or several of them. And some cymbals and a few other percussion instruments. Okay, I will. Hopefully, I didn't undersell that. it was a neat concept piece. So other artists had gone on and done other audio and musical performances and pieces with EEG signal. David Rosenboom was an artist in the 70s who. Did a couple of shows, one called Ecology of the Skin in 1970. We don't actually have any video or audio that I could find anywhere. Just get the schematic of the EEG. Sounds great. There were 10 participants. They were controlling key mixing of music from keyboard performers, so they were acting as mixers. They were acting as 10 different mixers, and there were some visuals with phosphine stimulators. Then another piece he did in 1977 called On Being Visible at a music gallery in Toronto in 1977. And this was using event-related potentials from two performers' brains. So event-related potentials are exactly what they sound like. They're EEG signal that responds to some event. Usually it would be some stimulus, so a visual stimulus, and you'll see this deflection, this voltage change, or an audio stimulus, or a tactile stimulus, and then you see a voltage related to that. So that's called a event-related potential. It's just a potential voltage related to some. So that's what he used as the signal, and he had two bits here. First is more pure sound. Is more, he used more human voices and piano sound.
It has rallied the thus emerged in that dilemma of for him a profound works through the complexities of the problem
So we don't have a whole lot of detail about how that happened, but presumably the event-related potentials triggered different sounds, voices, what have you. A lot of this is with all due respect, some artists kind of, you know, doing, so we don't know what, we don't have enough detail to know what worked or if it really even was really working or if they were actually working with noise instead of real EEG signal or not. It's sort of difficult to tell. But it certainly, EEG keeps kind of lending itself towards turning into sound music. You just see this over and over again. Yeah. An old what?
The synthesizer.
Oh, good question. Yeah, that's a question you guys could probably answer better than I. Yeah.
Anybody know what it is?
Well, the block diagram from the previous slides showed an ARC synthesizer in his 1970 work.
Yeah, right here.
So it could be that he's still using an ARC, but I don't.
The next one looks more like a Blucher, I think. It's more smooth. It's not as sharply defined.
This one.
Yeah, the one in the picture with the block diagram, though,
yeah, that's
a 2600.
Sure.
Well, I can say this is the first crowd that's been able to identify that or even had a question related to that. I was totally unprepared for that question. That's pretty great, actually. It's a good crowd. So other things have been... just kind of moving forward more quickly, the things that have been done more recently, other things include taking EEG waveform analysis and use it to control sound passively, meaning you record an EEG and then later use that as sort of a score to control a piece, or using alpha versus beta rhythm, so just those different frequency ranges, control a style of music, or using the visual evoke potentials to control music mixing, and then converting a signal of a seizure into sound. This is pretty neat. I think this was in, they talked about this in CNN briefly, but it was a group in Stanford that just they just converted EEG signal into voices to try to make seizures sound more human, if you're going to sonify it. So I'll just play this, but this is a seizure that's been sonified. So you're listening to brain signal from a patient who's having a seizure, and you can hear the evolution of the seizure. So a seizure typically starts off somewhat slow and low amplitude, and it's periodic, and then it becomes faster and more and higher amplitude, and then it kind of burns out and slows down again. So that's the typical arc of a seizure. Now, again, this EEG signal is not in the auditory range. If you just do a one-to-one translation of the frequencies, for the most part, it's, you know, going to be well below 20 hertz. They interpreted, and then they interpreted into a voice. So that's what you'll hear.
Yeah.
That's very can be very disturbing. Yeah.
did they raise the frequency? What, 5-6 octaves or something like? And then on the timeline, was compression applied, or was that actually?
It was real time. I know that. Yeah. So they only did a. But you have to kind of, I mean, if you think about it, you got to sample over a certain period of time and then convert. So, but I know that was in real time, regardless. Wow. Although, I think what you'd have to do, right, at some point, you have to take 10 hertz and make it into 100. But you have to sample over a certain period of time. But that was real time. So the typical seizure will last around 3 minutes or so, if all goes well. They burn out on their own, but that's what you were hearing. And this was after the fact. They didn't make someone have a seizure for this, for the purposes of doing this. But doing EEG in the hospital, I see seizures all the time. You know, it's a controlled environment. I know it's disturbing to hear that, but oftentimes the EEG is needed to find out exactly where the seizure is coming from, and the only way you'll know for sure is if they have an actual seizure.
The different pitches represent a specific electrical.
I think that they were using different voices and different electrodes, and then I believe, and then frequency range was just pure translated into just tone. Yeah, I believe, but you clearly heard several different sort of voices there, and I think those were different electrodes or regions, but I'm not entirely sure of that. Yeah.
For someone that studies this, often does listening to a piece of music like this help shed light on what you're analyzing on a day-to-day basis?
I don't know. I mean, I think so. I kind of intuitively feel like it does, you know, being a musician and an EEG expert. I've often thought, I've heard others talk, you know, we use audio to monitor EKG, the heart, all the time. You know, there are monitors and alarms that'll go off, and it's a huge amount of data you have there going in front of you with an EEG. There are these 20 different lines, and you're kind of trying to analyze it in real time using your vision and your brain. And there's been intensive research over many years trying to come up with automated algorithms, you know, so that this can just be, you know, they can just be recognized. The computer can just do the whole thing for me and say, oh, well, there's a seizure, there's not a seizure. But to this day, it's still, the algorithms haven't worked that well. So one thought is that using this for monitoring might be useful to have this in the room. If you're trained and you can hear that, our auditory system's actually much better than our visual system at picking out multiple different signals at the same time. We're really good at picking up, you know, as probably everyone in this room just knows intuitively, if not from data, that you can pick out 10 sounds much better than you can pick out 10 things moving around, and kind of keep track of that. So it might be a really good way to monitor EEG beyond visual tracking. And I've often thought, you know, it'd be great to have this set up, but it would be important to do it in a meaningful way, right? You're doing a translation there and an interpretation into a certain sound, and depending on how you do that, you might make it better or worse. But it's an interesting problem from a diagnostic standpoint. It might be really useful to help understand or pick out patterns for humans to pick out patterns. Using sound, because we do it visually right now. We don't use sound. And I think I would do a better job with the audio. I'm more of an audio person than a visual person. But our brains are also well adapted to picking up, you know, one sound out of many. You can think about, you know, your grandmother is in the corner of a loud room and there's a bunch of people talking. You're going to be able to pick out your grandmother in a second. And you might also say, oh, and there's Joe over there and there's Sally in that corner. And
you know, she's annoyed and she's happy and grandmother is happy to see me. You know, all that happens in a few seconds. And there's a cricket over there. And, you know, I just heard a glass. Like, if you think about that, we're really good at picking those things out. So my device is a brain-computer interface, and it's not only the first brain-computer interface. It's, you know, one of many, many, many that have been going on. Research has been going on for a really long time. Basically, a brain-computer interface is something that communicates directly between the brain and some kind of external computing device or output without going through the conventional body of the human. So brain-computer interfaces have been used to try to help human motor functions, cognitive functions for a long time. Research really started in the 70s with DARPA and NSF. So we've been doing research on this for, you know, 40 plus years. But even now, with surface EEG, meaning putting EEG on the scalp as opposed to plunging electrodes into the brain, our control is just not that good. We've kind of reached some limits. They may not be absolute permanent limits, but they're things definitely kind of flatten out around 75%, 80% accuracy of, say, moving a cursor on a screen or controlling some other device in general. Those are the kind of accuracies, unfortunately, we get to 75, maybe 80%. But why, you know, why is that? Why can't we do better? Well, you remember at the beginning when I was talking about all these things about EEG, there's a lot of artifact, there's a lot of noise, and there's a specificity problem about what's the signal. And then it's the signal always there. Some of these signals aren't in 100% of people. Sometimes the signals kind of wax and wane during the day, and then we have all this noise and artifact issues. But some of the signals that have been used to try to control brain-computer interfaces include, these are the four big ones that people tend to use, something called slow cortical potentials. They're slow, and in the EEG world, that means like 1 to 2 seconds long. They become positive when there's less activity and negative for more activity. There are various different kind of things that can turn them on and turn them off. They take extensive training to get good at, and they're very, very variable between individuals and day-to-day, depending on their emotional state, their wakefulness, and things like that. So it can be kind of a sticky signal. There's the P300, just called P300 because it's positive at 300 milliseconds, which is an event-related potential. So that's anything that's infrequent or novel or something you're focusing on in a group, when that's highlighted, you're likely to have a P300. So, for example, if I show you a picture of an elephant, everyone would probably get a P300 signal right after seeing the elephant because it's just a new thing. It's a novel stimulus. If I show you the elephant the second time, you'll get another P300. It'll be a little smaller. And after about the third or fourth time, your brain's no longer interested in it being novel, and so your P300 goes away. But then I show you a picture of like a monkey, you'll get a P300 again because it's new and surprising. And then I go back to the elephant. You might get one more for the elephant, and then, you know, you kind of get the picture. But our brains are meant to pick up novel things, and the brain quickly drops signals to things that aren't novel very quickly, gets bored easily, so to speak, just because it's not worth processing every time as a novel thing. So anyway, the P300 is a signal that you can use, and one way in which that is used is a P300 speller. So people who can't speak or type, you can show them I think actually this is a P300 speller screen. So you show them a list of letters and numbers, and they focus on the letter that they want. And when it flashes, then you'll get a P300. So by rapidly flashing columns and rows, you will quickly, uniquely figure out which letter that they're focusing on, because the P300 will only light up when you get either a column or row that lines up with the letter or number. So it's just another signal that can be used to try to control something. There are these things called steady-state visual evoke potentials. I'll show you an example of a brain-computer interface with that. Those are signals that come in the back of the brain, the visual cortex, that are periodic and will entrain to some frequency of light. So if you flash a light at 20 hertz, a 20 hertz light, and your eyes are open, you're looking at it, you'll get a 20 hertz signal in the visual cortex in the brain. So if I have a 20 hertz signal here and then I got a 15 hertz signal there, you can look at one or the other and we'll be able to tell which one you're looking at. Because if you're looking at the 15 hertz, we get 15 hertz here. If you're looking at the 20 hertz, you get 20 hertz here. It's pretty neat, but if you think about it, it's not really necessary to go through the whole brain signal issue. You can just do an eye tracker. So I personally think it's kind of nifty, but you know, there's a simpler way to get to skip that. And then there are event-related desynchronizations and resynchronizations. So that's things like the visual cortex, that posterior dominant rhythm. When you close your eyes, that signal comes on. When you open your eyes, it goes away. But again, I think a similar thing, if you can open and close your eyes to turn on and off a signal, you can just look at the eyes opening and closing and use that as a signal control or an eye tracker. And then there's the mu rhythm, and that's the reason I chose the mu rhythm, is that is a signal that we talked about earlier in the motor cortex that turns on and off when you're thinking about movement. So that doesn't require any movement whatsoever. You can have your eyes open, you can have your eyes closed, it doesn't matter. If you can't move your eyes, you can still do it. That's a pure, it's a pure thought, really. So that's the main reason why I chose that rhythm. This is a SSVP-based brain-computer interface. So that's the somatosensory visual evoke potential, where you're looking at the flashing light and picking up that frequency. So this is a group at UW with Raj Rao. He's one of the leading brain-computer interface researchers in the world, really. He's I know him pretty well. He's a great guy. You might have seen he had a brain-brain interface where, you know, one person's signal was controlling the other person's actual motor cortex and making them move. It's like a remote control human. But this was from a few years ago, just using an SSVP. But just, it gives you an idea of how difficult it is.
Experiment started. Okay, so I'm going to grab the orange juice.
And how slow and kind of painful it is to use these signals to try to get. This is why we don't have people walking around with electrodes just driving cars and doing things. It's just not, it's difficult. So those are different frequencies of light, and by looking at the different frequencies, we can tell which one he's looking at with the EEG, and each of the flashing lights corresponds to a different command, so you can, it's probably hard to read, but bottom left says head down, the one on the left says head up, the one in the middle says head left. And head right in the lower right corner, and then grasp is the one up there. So he's trying to control this robot to pick up the right juice bottle. You notice how much time has passed just trying to get him to look at the thing. So the goal is to get the robot to look at the right juice bottle and then hit the grasp, and then it'll do a whole program that goes out and grasps. See how frustrating that might be if you're a patient who's paralyzed and you're using this to go around. That's going to be very difficult. So that's the surface EEG, and that's where we're at with it. You can do much better
and get much more specific signal, get rid of the artifact, get much more fine control from electrodes that are implanted right at the brain surface or in the brain. To do that, of course, you need to cut the skull open. You need to put something into someone's brain. And that's a lot. There are people who are paralyzed who are willing to, like this subject, to have that done because their quality of life is so bad without this that they're willing to take on the risk of infection, doing a whole brain surgery to get electrodes planted in your brain. They also tend to scar off and the signal kind of fades after a while, so that can be incredibly frustrating. You get this whole thing set up and a whole surgery, and then it just kind of stops working after a year or two. What we're looking at with surface EEG is up here, and then we've got the scalp, we've got the skull, we've got these coverings, these hard coverings called the meninges, and then we finally get to brain. So EEG, or the surface EEG that we're doing, is up here. There's ECOG, where you put electrodes right on the surface of the brain, and then there's intraparenchymal, or more invasive stuff, where you actually implant electrodes. So we do this a lot, relatively a lot, in the hospital with patients with epilepsy. So if you have epilepsy and it's not able to be controlled with medicines, you might be in such bad shape that and the seizures are really just completely affecting your life, might have to go in and take out a piece of brain by surgery. And to do that, you want to find out, obviously, exactly where the seizures are coming from. The surface EEG we had, like I told you, doesn't have the resolution. So, you know, if we saw the seizures coming from this area of a few centimeters, then we went in and we just took that whole part of the brain out, we'd be taking out more brain than we needed to. And obviously that's going to affect somebody, because you need parts of your brain. So what we'll do is we'll implant electrodes either on the surface or actually impaled in, and we'll leave the electrodes in for a few days, and then we record, and we will look and see where the seizures are coming from. And the idea is, one, to make sure we take out the smallest piece of brain necessary to eliminate the seizure. So we really want to find the source, and sometimes a seizure will start in an area of, you know, a square millimeter, and then it can spread very rapidly, like within milliseconds it can spread. But if we take out the original source, it's a tiny piece of brain, we can stop the whole process, and then there's minimal effects on the patient. The second thing we want to do is map the brain, because everyone's brain is a little different. We know where most functions are, but everyone's a little different. We want to make sure that if we know what we're taking out and how that's going to affect someone. So we'll actually stimulate parts of the brain with electrodes and basically see what happens. I haven't done this for a few years, but it was honestly the most fun, interesting part of my job would be to have, we have this grid of electrodes and we just systematically go through and stimulate at higher and higher voltages until you get an effect. And you know, if you're in the motor cortex, you might see a finger move. If you're in the sensory cortex, the patient can be awake and they'll say, "Oh, I'm, you know, feeling some tingling here." So then you know that that's the sensor area for that part of the hand. Or they may get visual effects from the visual part of the brain, or speech from language parts of the brain. And the whole idea is to find out, you know, what their map of their brain is. You take out the minimal brain necessary. So that is the whole reason that we've done this historically, is to, for epilepsy surgery. But what was learned from all that is very useful for brain-computer interfaces, because we can then go and map their brain and find out where their control, if a person has ALS, for example, their motor neurons no longer work, their brain is fine, and the part of their brain that controls their arm no longer is able to tell the arm to move. So we could go and map and find out where their right arm area is and then implant an electrode there and have it control something instead, have it control a robot arm or type something on a screen to enable them. So these invasive brain-computer interfaces
can go much, much farther, but a lot of disadvantages. It's highly invasive. You can get infections easily and scarring. And it's not something you can kind of scale to thousands of people. This is for kind of occasional and for the right type of patient. So needless to say, when I decided I was going to make a brain music interface, I didn't think I'd get too many volunteers to have the brain cut open and take chunks of brain out and plant electrodes. So I worked with the surface EEG. So I invented this brain-computer interface that produces music, which I call the encephalophone. It's a pretty logical name. Encephalo means head, technically, but we use it to mean brain most of the time. It's a Greek word, and phone, from like saxophone. So the rationale was that that 75-80% of accuracy that we get with surface EEG these days, it's not good enough to control a robot arm, but it can be good enough if you have some sense of control to feel like you're actually creating music that you're controlling. I think one of my school music colleagues said, yeah, good enough for jazz. You know, you get one wrong note in there as long as it stays in the same key. So I thought that was pretty neat. It really started off as just a creative project. I was doing neurophysiology. I was even doing, research on music cognition. And I'm a musician. And I'd seen what people had done in the past with sound and with music using EEG signal. And I said, you know what, I can do better because I know the signal better. So the idea is that music can be created without any movement by thought control, if you will. And those are, they're signals. People often ask me, are you thinking about notes? No. We don't know how to measure those signals. I can't look with the EEG and say, oh, he's thinking C sharp, so I'll make a C sharp. So I worked with the signal that was practical, that we knew about, that I knew we'd be able to use to control things, and that's the motor imagery control, that mu that I was telling you about. So the goals are really twofold. One is purely creative, the way it started off, just artistic and musical. It's a novel musical instrument and real-time composition device, if you will. And the other is more something I'm working with patients. I had invented this thing, and I thought, wow, this could be really neat to bring to patients who lost the ability to play music or sing. They've suddenly had a stroke, or they get ALS, and they were a musician, and they can't do it anymore. Their brain is perfectly good, and they have problems controlling or moving at all their arms and legs. I thought this would be really neat to bring to people. And then there's also some evidence that it might actually be useful not just to re-enable people, but also therapeutically. I'll talk about that a little bit. But here's the basic design. So we got the EEG cap on people, like the electrodes. It's hooked up to the amplifier, the EEG amplifier, which is also an AD. That goes to computer number one. There I do most of all the complex algorithms, the signal processing goes through MATLAB. Then from MATLAB, I basically stream a number out the other end. So it just comes out as a number from 1 to 8, 8 being highest signal, 1 being the lowest. So I've kind of encapsulated that in computer number one, and it's just a send. So it's then send by OSC to a second computer. That's where I do the audio engine. It was originally in Max, and now we're doing it in Super Collider. But that could be any of a number of things, and you could take that signal and have it turn into anything you want. You could.
Are the 1 through 8 related to, say, the diatonic scale? Is that the idea?
Yeah, for now, and obviously you can change that however you want. We for the moment it is, yeah, it's purely controlling tone. So yeah, it's just a, that's kind of how I came up with 1 to 8. Also, we're not going to get much more resolution than that. So, it works even better if you do like a pentatonic scale. It's only really 1 to 5 or 1 to 4. You just don't have that much control and fine control. I mean, honestly, the easiest thing would be just 0 and 1, like on off. But you can control the middle pretty well with some learning. So 1 to 8 sort of made sense musically because it was like a whole, you know, diatonic scale with the octave, and that's what we've stuck with. And, you know, you can, as I'll show you, we can easily change scales and octaves and, you know, flip to other instruments. You know, you can do MIDI instruments or all kinds of other things. At the DW, we have a disc clavier that's, so you can, you know, remote controlled actual physical piano. So patients could actually be playing a real piano without touching it, which is kind of neat. So then we produce the musical feedback. So that's the design. This is the early beta. This is really early, like years ago. Very crude. And there's some glitches in the video, sorry. Just a piano on a C scale, and there's computer one and computer two. Computer one, that's the raw signal on the EG there. That's the amplifier. But eventually I wanted to do this as a scientist also, not just as a, you know, musician. I wanted to prove that this worked. I didn't want to create something. I could put electrodes on my head and just have anything come out the other end and just tell people, oh yeah, I'm controlling this with my brain. And, you know, sure you are. and quite honestly, that's what a lot of the projects in the past, you look at these some of these EEG projects, and you just have to have a religious faith that they're, you know, really doing something. But I knew I could do it in a way that actually worked, and I wanted to set about proving it. And so we did carefully conducted experiments to make sure that people had actual control. And so we published this finally after a million years back in April. And it's very old data, and it's like the very beginning, and we have lots of other stuff since then. But there is this paper. And what we did here, you've already seen this, but this is the basic setup, but also the experimental setup. So I kind of walked you through that. Out the other end, you're hearing notes, 8 notes on a C scale. This is for testing purposes, not for performance purposes. Now, they're constantly coming out. The only thing you're controlling is pitch. So there's just one. You know, it's 120 beats a minute. You just get a note every half second. The test was to match notes. So we'd give people a target tone, and they have 10 seconds. It actually was 9.5 seconds, which is annoying, and it had something to do with zero indexing. But about 10 seconds, you get to match the note 3 times in a row. If you match the note 3 times in a row, within 10 seconds, then you score a hit. If you don't, you score a miss, and you get a new note. We did 5 minutes. So in 5 minutes, you have to try to match as many as you can. We took novices, meaning we didn't train people for a long period of time and then have them do that. So this is just people first time doing this. They get 5 minutes of training, basically. We hook them up and just give them the idea for 5 minutes, and that's it. And then we test them. So that was the idea of this first paper, was just take normal, healthy people, total novices, and just see if they're able to do accuracy. The goal here was only to see if they could do better than random. That's it. So random, it turns out, is 18% accuracy with this paradigm. It's not as simple as I'd thought mathematically. We had to really work that out. But this is the group. So there were 15 subjects. Various ages, roughly equal gender, and years of musical training was noted. Although we were not trying to make a statement about musical training, but we would assume that people with musical training would do better. You'd be able to pitch find easier and just know where you're going, know where you are better. That was that would seem like an obvious likelihood, but we noted musical training years for. So the basic experiment, just finding if they did better than random. Everyone did better than random. We had two modes. We had the PDR, so that's the visual cortex. That was kind of a proof of principle. Very easy, you know, close your eyes, you go up and you get a higher note. Open your eyes, you come down, you get a lower note. We knew that was easy. We knew that's not quite as interesting because, again, you can just use an eye tracker to measure opening and closing. But we wanted to just make sure the proof of principle that would work. But the real experiment is this mode, the mu accuracy. And so here's random, which is around 18%. And this is the cluster of people. Everyone did better than random, and everyone did significantly better than random. And the average here was about 65%. And the average here is around 57%. And again, random is 18%. So people did better than random. 57% is not that great control, you know, like just over 50% of the time. We wanted to make sure that people were, if they were extremely biased towards one note or the other, you could imagine they're just putting out eight notes. And so they'll always get the eight. Or if the target tone is eight, they'll always get it because they're just putting out noisy signal and it's always producing an 8. So we looked at their skew, and then if someone was highly skewed, like this person's highly skewed to 8, then we'd throw out all the 8s and see how did they do on the 1s only, on the other target notes. And they all did better than average, even when you take the skew into account. And then another figure I don't have here is we did look at years of musical training, and there was a non-significant trend towards better accuracy with musical training, which is not a shocker. But we didn't prove that to a statistical level of significance. So now what we're doing with sort of healthy subjects is, we're now going to look at the effect of training. It's well known that these types of brain-computer interfaces, people improve with training, as you might expect. You know, you have to kind of learn an instrument like any other musical instrument, and you get better at it. And people definitely get better at it, but we're going to more precisely measure that over a series of training sessions over 3 months and take a limited number of subjects. We're going to take ringers. We're going to take musicians. And we're just going to see how well people can do as a group over time. And we have more difficult tests. So, you know, we start off with just the target note of the 8 or the 1. So they're either hitting the high C or the low C. And then if they get good at that, we introduce the 5th. And so then they have to hit the 1, the 5, or the 8. Then if they get good at that, we do the 1, the 3, the 5, and the 8. Just to see if they can get a little bit more accuracy. I don't think we'll ever get to a point when I can put a Mozart score in front of you and you'll be able to follow it. It's always going to be an improvisational instrument because there's always going to be error. You're never going to be perfectly accurate. But people with training have gotten a lot better, and I've played with it a lot, of course, and I've gotten much better. And you know, my accuracy goes up higher, and it starts to be a lot more expressive, obviously, if you have more control over it. So that's sort of with quote-unquote normals, testing-wise. We also have, you know, musical applications for performance, and we did a performance last year at this Art and Technology Festival in October called 92. It was the 50th anniversary of the 9 evenings that Robert Rauschenberg and John Cage and others did in New York in 1966. And we did a performance at that festival with a jazz ensemble. Some of you saw that video. I'll show you the video again. We've just started clinical trials with the encephalophone with people with motor disabilities. So I'll talk a little more about that. So there's this festival I mentioned. We got a small grant from For Culture and from the festival itself to put this on. And it was an original composition by a composer and music technologist who's at DX Arts, Marcin Pezkowski. And we got a jazz ensemble together. And we also had some visuals where we had a visual artist who did projections that would use the live signal. So what you'll see is me playing the encephalophone. I'm in a chair. I'm not moving. So, you know, it's an interesting problem for live performance because it looks like nothing's going on. It's like, what are you? Are you... What instrument are you? You know, I'm not moving much. That posed an interesting problem just from a performance standpoint. But also, I intentionally chose acoustic musicians, and then I'm always a synthesizer, more electronic type sound. So that's what you'll listen for if you're trying to hear me. We use different timbres and instruments, but I'm always a non-acoustic instrument. So that's a big hint. Another really interesting thing from a performance standpoint is it's not very musical if you're just constantly cranking out notes. So like even if I'm moving up and down pitches, you know, that's not musical phrasing. Rests and phrasing are important. So how do you create phrasing without movement? Well, we can't right now. We just can't. So I used a foot pedal as a volume pedal to sort of turn it on and off so we could have phrasing. That posed a really interesting musical neuroscience problem because I wanted to make sure I wasn't cheating in any way with the foot pedal affecting the motor cortex to affect the signal of the pitch. So I purposely chose the left foot because that area was farthest away from the right hand area in the brain, so it shouldn't affect the signal that I'm using to control pitch. So that was the left foot. It really should not affect things at all. So the left side of the brain controls the right side of the body. The left motor cortex is here. The hand area is right here. The foot area is further up, and I chose the other side. So it's the other hemisphere of the brain. So it shouldn't have affected that. Then we added one more control surface, and now we're cheating again in a way. But we wanted to add a sustain pedal, and this was actually a very really, really interesting musical, electrical engineering, and neuroscience problem that I'm pretty happy about the you know, these are the kind of experiments we were doing to try to figure out how to make this work for performance that really helped me learn a lot about this. So I didn't have many limbs left, and the sustain ended up being best used with the hand. So now we're getting closer. I use the left hand, but it's still the hand. And the left hand area does affect slightly the right part of the brain. So the left motor cortex controls the right hand. However, hand movement will not only affect the mu signal here, but it'll have a small opposite effect on the same side. So this got a little complicated. The interesting thing is that there's a significant delay in that signal change to the same side. So that signal will arrive about a half a second later, that change. So if you think about a sustain pedal, I hit it, I aim for a note, I grab that note. Now I'm going to affect the signal, but I'll affect the signal 500 milliseconds later. By then, I'm just holding this note, so it doesn't matter. Then when I'm ready to move on, I let go of the sustain pedal, and we're back, and I can go find pitches. So it actually didn't affect things because we're sustaining, and we're not hearing the other tones in the meantime. It should, yes. And so there's going to be another, you know, a little half second there. So maybe for a second I was having trouble controlling again, and you know, I used it sparingly, but it was kind of an interesting problem. Now, for patients, I'm going to try to introduce a little bit of control, and we can possibly use other brain signals to control some of those things instead of non-movement. Another possibility is I'm working with an ALS patient now who's paralyzed from the neck down. He still has eye movement. He can't speak. He still has facial expression. So what I'm doing right now is when he opens his eyes, it's on. When he closes his eyes, I turn it off. I'm just manually doing that right now, but we may add an eye tracker, which would allow him to control his on and offs by just opening and closing his eyes. Not every patient can even move their eyes or open and close their eyes, but we're trying to figure out how to make it more musical and make the expression better. Anyway, I'll... Oh, yeah.
So if I understand what you're
controlling the pitch by imaginarily using your imagination to control your right hand.
Yeah, you're imagining your hand opening and closing or not, and different levels of movement of the right hand.
And so it's an imagination of the movement of the right hand that you're using to control the pitch.
Yeah, but importantly, if I did actual movement, that also will affect the signal. But we're trying to make it so that you don't have to move at all. That's the ideals, so that it could be used for paralyzed patients. And also because there's sort of no point in using brain signal if you can move. you can use your brain signal to control music right now, you know, with your hands. You don't need all this gear. I play trumpet. I probably play this better than the trumpet. But, you know. That accuracy is higher than my trumpet accuracy. But the idea is to do without movement. But all these movements and imagining movements will all affect the signal somewhat. All right, so anyway, I'll show you this performance. Some of you have seen this video. This is the... that's the wrong one, sorry. I just jumped ahead. Escape. Oh, no, it's crashing. I think I'm going to have to force quit. Does anyone... know how I can get out of here. What's that? Yeah.
Yeah.
When full screen, I don't know how to get to it. Say that. You feel free to.
Does that make any sense?
Oh yeah, there you go. Yep. It will only take a second. Apologies for that. I'll go through this pretty quick, actually. Yeah, I'll take a break in 1 second. I'll just show you a couple videos. We're pretty much done. Computer almost gave me a break. Forced break. All right. Let's see. That should go. Yeah. Here we go. The volume pedal on my left foot, sustain pedal on my left hand. I'm not playing now. Bass type of. There's a sustain there. Well. Interest of time. And this is a a brief video about a particular patient that we've worked with.
Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like me. I once was lost. I once was lost, but now.
Don't worry, sorry.
By the river.
Or a small city, yeah. It's new,
the river.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is... Yeah, that probably
sounds
good.
All right, here we go.
I was on service, meaning I was covering the neurology admissions to the hospital when Margaret presented to the emergency department with, I think, the only time I've ever had a chief complaint of, I can't sing.
Margaret Haney, and I teach fifth grade.
The emergency department doctors took her seriously, which was great. Ended up getting an MRI, and when it was abnormal, she was admitted to me to help figure out what the cause was of her problem.
I was attempting to sing with my students in the classroom, and I tried to just impromptu sing Summertime, which has quite a range, and I failed miserably. Like I never have, and my students were giving me some funny looks. So I tried instead to sing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning from Oklahoma. And I couldn't find the notes to save my life, and it's a song I've been singing since I was 4 years old.
Her neurologic exam otherwise was completely normal, and you would think she was normal until she started to try and sing, and it was off key. She could get kind of the rhythm of a song, but it would be off pitch and off key.
And so one of my students sneaked back to the computer, a couple of them, on the computer and Googled, what does it mean when you can't find familiar notes that you've known your whole life? And up came a Musia, and they brought me a printout that I pretended to not be alarmed about, but when I saw the words brain damage, then I thought, I've had a stroke.
It turned out she didn't have a stroke, but she did have an encephalitis, an infection of the brain, a viral infection of the brain. And it was so specific that it only took out her ability to generate music.
The majority of people who have encephalitis present after they have a seizure, or they start to get weak on one side or have really serious symptoms. But I think in Margaret's case, it was found really early because of the singing.
Dr. Hensley came to me and said, you really should see this case. This is right up your alley. It's someone I know you would be interested in. I talked to her about your work, and she's very interested in meeting you. And she showed me the MRI of the brain, and as she started to bring it up, I said, you know what, don't show it to me. I'm going to tell you exactly where her lesion is. And sure enough, I was correct down to the centimeter. There's a very specific part of the brain that would be used in this function, and sure enough, she had an infection of just that one part of her brain. Encephalophone is a musical instrument that's generated, where music is generated from brain waves or the electrical activity of the brain. It is essentially a brain-computer interface which generates music as opposed to visual feedback, for example. So
What it does is it takes intentional control, so thoughts, if you will, that can be directed towards generating scalar music, so musical notes. So this is on my head. It's measuring the electrical activity of the brain. We particularly focus on one area or another. So the main control mode that we use is the motor cortex. So up here on the left side of the brain is the motor cortex. So in this case, we listen to the motor cortex, and then we use imagery of thinking about moving the right arm. The motor cortex has a resting pattern. So if you're awake and you're not doing anything, you're not moving in particular, but you're awake, there's a resting pattern that we can measure right here. And when you go to move, if I go and I move my right arm, that resting activity will go away. The brain will be kicked into gear, and there'll be other patterns that can be pulled out that are initiating movement of the right arm. I talked to Margaret, and we decided to try to use the encephalophone as a therapy for her. So she had lost the ability to generate pitches the natural way with her normal brain mechanism, but the encephalophone uses a different part of the brain. So she had part of her right temporal cortex. That part of her brain over here was not functioning because of this encephalitis. And who knows if it was going to come back. It certainly wasn't going to heal completely, but maybe heal a little bit. So that part is gone. The encephalophone was using this part, the left motor cortex, a totally different area, in order to generate music. So thought, if we can train her to use this part of the brain, she may be able to generate pitches using the encephalophone. Not so much singing, but by using her motor cortex, and she might learn a new way or a new circuit, a new pathway in order to generate pitches on a musical scale. So we took her in, we gave her a standard test of amusia to get a baseline to understand where her disabilities lay. And then we began testing her and training her with the encephalophone. We would have her play along with music just freely, and then we would test her on a note tester that would ask her to try to hit certain pitches.
But I can aim for the sound and know that I haven't hit it and adjust it. I haven't worked so hard in all my life.
She began to use this and improved her pitch finding ability somewhat. It was really a pretty unique application for the encephalophone. In fact, it's kind of a one in a million case that was exactly the type of lesion or problem with the brain that the encephalophone could address. I thought it would be both interesting from an artistic standpoint, but also from a potential therapeutic aspect, to take one of these brain-computer interfaces and have it generate in real time scalar music, just to make an instrument, essentially, just like you would create a new musical instrument with a different type of control. This control would be EEG. Going forward, I'm planning on using it not so much for amusia cases, because they will probably continue to be one in a million pure amusia, but patients who have lost their ability to move their arms or legs from stroke or from other disorders can use the encephalophone to generate music. Even if they can't move their arm to play a violin or a piano, they'd be able to generate music using their motor cortex, even if that motor cortex doesn't drive the use of their arm. I also hope one day to take that, if someone has learned this use of their motor cortex to generate music, tie that into their rehab. So someone undergoing physical therapy to try to improve their strength could use the encephalophone by itself at first, but then start using it alongside their physical therapy, so that eventually maybe we can improve their movement. That's pretty much it. But it's kind of a example. Just real briefly, things in the future. You know, we could use this not just to control tones on a scale, but chords or tempo or instrument groups. We could have multiple performers. It could be diagnostic. We were talking about the use of sound for diagnosing using EEG, and then therapeutic, as I mentioned, not just being able to re-enable people who can't move and play music anymore to allow them to play music again, but hopefully actually improving their motor rehabilitation and helping them rewire their brains. So we got approved to do clinical trials, which we've just begun at Swedish Hospital. We have a tiny grant that's covering part of it from the National Endowment for the Arts. We're giving patients with motor disability who previously were musicians but are no longer able to play music because of their disability from stroke or from ALS or from MS or from spinal cord injury. They have three sessions during which we test them with the same note tester, but also allow them to play along with a musical accompaniment. And I've just run the first patient two of his three sessions, Friday and Monday, and he did 65% on Friday and 93% on Monday, which is unbelievable. It's about as high as we've gotten. So he has ALS. I can't tell you too much details for privacy reasons, but he's paralyzed from the neck down, essentially. He can't move at all below the neck, and he has eye movement, facial expression. He cannot speak. He uses a Microsoft Kinect with an eye tracker to help spell very slowly. But he was a former musician, composer, pianist, and singer. And I could just tell you without words that he is really excited to be able to play music again. So it's really exciting and very satisfying to be able to actually bring this. But need funding. So if anybody really desperate for funding, doing that, this has all been pretty much self-funded, with trickles of money from other things. I'm doing the entire thing by myself. Go to my website if you know anyone who want to help contribute to help enable patients to play music again. Please do. That's it. What's that? No, I think I might. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a pretty compelling story, and you know.
Regarding, I believe her name was Margaret, the lady who couldn't sing Amazing Grace in tune. Mm-hmm. Was there, after this, an improvement in her ability to sing in tune?
Yes, there was. Now, that is more difficult to measure precisely, but we did the amusia testing panel. It's called the Montreal Battery of Amusia, and it's a cognitive testing tool, and she improved in those categories on the testing. So yes, now we can't say it's an N of one, as you say in science. There's no control. She's just one person, so we can't say anything about significance. She might have gotten better on her own. Maybe she was just practicing music in some way at all. But I'd like to think that we helped her along. And she did say that in singing, she started using the strategy. She started tying together singing with thinking about moving her arm, because that was how she learned how to play the encephalophone, and it helped her with her singing. She'd sort of start doing arm movements, and that would sort of, that imagining that, that would help her.
Yeah, because the octave, she was on a different pitch. She couldn't, couldn't hit it. And I wondered.
And we had recordings of her singing before. She's an excellent, excellent singer.
Yeah, so how, it'd be interesting to see how it went.
Yeah, and she did improve, and we heard her sing. It would be good to have that in the video as well, like a before and an after. But she did improve. We can't prove
that we did that. And she, you know, she may have done some healing on her own, but I'd like to think we helped her. And we'll, that part of the clinical trials is to find out if we can actually help people and not just think we're helping people.
Are your clinical trials still open?
This is only the first one. I will definitely do more after this. This is a very simple one with 15 patients. I don't have 15 line up. It will not be a... Yeah. Well, I can give you information how you could, I could sign up. Even if it's not this initial one, we'll, like I said, we'll definitely open this up bigger. It started off with 15, and we're just doing very simple testing because we just want to do a proof that this will work with patients, and I have no doubt that we'll be successful. But part of the bureaucracy of working at the hospital in formal clinical trials involves, you know, huge amounts. So that's why we kept it simple for this first trial.
We gladly supply anything.
Yeah. Well, it's fun. I can tell you the patients we've done so far are pretty excited about it. It's fun. Oh, okay, great. That's excellent. That'll probably make it even easier. All right. Well, I'll give you my card. And,
okay.
Yeah. All right. Well, that went longer than expected, so thanks for bearing with me.
All right. Thank you very much. That was great. If there's no more questions, we'll take an intermission now. Tom?
I was just going to ask why you didn't mention the concert for last spring.
What's
concert
that?
Last spring?
Concert last spring. The Meany Hall concert.
Oh, well, I wasn't actually involved in that.
Oh, okay.
Directly. I did a little bit of advising on that. And that was not the encephalophone.
That was not
the one. That was, someone else is also using EEG control. A bit, yeah. Yeah, it's a different entity. Yeah.
All right, we've got cookies out in the hallway, water over here, bathrooms are around the corner. We'll come back in about 15 minutes.
See, we're going to do a recap for...